At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
This is the real Monopoly, not a game. Not the one you pull out on a rainy afternoon anyway, not with friends. Forget the colorful board, the little plastic houses you snap onto Park Place. We're talking about something far more, well, insidious. A chilling, visceral rehearsal for the cold realities of debt and the crushing weight of obedience. This isn't just some quaint historical anecdote people tell. It feels more like a dark piece of folklore, a legend that really seeps into your bones. It's presented as a historical account, almost, of psychological manipulation, crafted with a kind of precision that, well, it defies simple storytelling. It feels less like a story and more like a warning, you know, etched into the collective unconscious.
And that's exactly where we have to start questioning things, isn't it? When something's labeled a game, especially one with such profound, unsettling results, designed not for fun, but for instruction, you have to immediately ask, what is this really? Is it just a game, some kind of forgotten ritual? Or is it something far more disturbing, like a deeply calculated social experiment, meticulously constructed maybe to test or even break the limits of the human psyche? It fundamentally challenges us, I think, to consider how fear, when it's applied subtly, incrementally, almost with a bureaucratic detachment, can become the most effective tool. Effective for imparting lessons that are not only fundamental, but often, well, cruelly indelible. Lessons that linger for generations.
Absolutely. It's a story that truly digs its claws in, raises so many uncomfortable questions about what control, like, really looks like. So our mission today, then, is to unravel that unnerving legend, the tale of the collector and his infamous basement board. We're going to try and extract the chilling insights here, the mechanisms of control, the insidious lessons of submission woven into its fabric, and the enduring impact of a game meticulously designed to warp perceptions, not just to entertain. Our deep dive will draw on sources that detail the chilling progression of this legend, yes, but also illuminate the underlying principles of how such a horror was constructed, and maybe even more importantly, how its victims perceived it, how they internalized it.
And this isn't just about digging up some historical oddity, is it? Or finding a strange story. It's about understanding how profoundly abstract concepts like debt, ownership, conditional existence can actually manifest, how they can become terrifyingly concrete and intensely personal. We're going to peel back the layers, try to see how these historical lessons, these chilling ideas embedded in folklore, might subtly resonate, how they adapt and maybe continue to influence our contemporary understanding of, well, personal agency and systemic control. Prepare yourself, really, to grasp how the whispers of the past often echo loudest in the present, if you just know how to listen, how to question what you're hearing.
Okay, so let's begin. Our journey into this dark folklore starts not with a whisper, but with this, the stark silhouette against the backdrop of the early 20th century. Imagine, if you can, the hushed rumors going through small towns. Tales of a figure known only as the Collector. A name that sounds less like a nickname and more like a decree. He wasn't some shadowy beast in the alleys. He was described as a perfectly tailored nightmare. And what made him particularly terrifying wasn't just his presence, but his method of payment. Utterly unique. Deeply disturbing. He didn't demand cash. That would be too simple, right? Too tangible. Something you could earn back. No. The Collector took something far more precious. Something linked to time, to innocence. He didn't take cash. He took children's nights until they said paid. Just imagine that. The fabric of their innocent time, their rest, systematically consumed, leaving them in this perpetual state of payment, this unspoken debt. And his appearance was apparently as unsettlingly precise as his methods. A black suit, a silver top hat, a cane tipped with a die, and a smile too wide to be kind. It's a vision designed to be imposing, yes, but also utterly devoid of genuine warmth, like a corporate Grim Reaper, but for childhood itself.
What's truly fascinating there, and deeply unsettling, is the symbolism. It's embedded not just in his actions, but in his whole persona. His formal attire, that impeccable black suit, the gleaming silver top hat, it doesn't scream criminal or villain in the usual sense. It speaks of something institutional, almost bureaucratic authority. It's this twisted formality, this rigid adherence to protocol that contrasts so sharply with his targets. Children, this isn't some ragged monster from the shadows. This is a figure cloaked in the precise, unassailable trappings of legitimate power, a kind of grim officialdom. It almost makes his actions seem, well, permissible somehow, even if horrific. and the payment in children's nights. That's not just poetic language for dread. It represents a fundamental consumption of innocence, of their capacity for unburdened rest, of freedom from obligation. It really echoes that chilling idea that some entities are ambient. They don't appear. They corrupt. The collector, seen this way, isn't just one terrifying guy. He's a chilling representation of an unseen system, a pervasive, corrupting influence that takes root in daily life in those stolen moments of rest. He's like the living embodiment of something larger, a system, a cover-up, a pattern, maybe a test. And his formal wear suggests he's just an administrator, a chillingly efficient cog in a much grander machine.
And where did this figure operate? Where did he enact this unspeakable collection? According to the local accounts, the unsettling ones, neighbors swore the collector's basement was a board. Not like a board, not metaphorically, but it was a board. The architecture merged with the gameplay. Picture this psychologically engineered environment. Black and red squares, stark, ominous, like some infernal checkerboard stretched across the whole space. These weren't just tiles, they were functional, decisive. And then the detail that really blurs the line makes it feel like a fabricated reality. Doorways as deeds. Each threshold, every literal step you take in that space, held this perverse legal weight, implying ownership, obligation, consequence with every single movement. But maybe the most disturbing detail, the one that seals it as a true trap, was the consensus. It was a circle no child ever finished. This wasn't a game with a win condition, you know, where you could collect your earnings and leave. This was a labyrinth designed for perpetual navigation, a trap, no true escape, just continuous looping until what? What was the point of an endless cycle like that?
Well, if we connect this to the principles of creating unseen horrors, the kinds that don't jump out but slowly crawl under your skin, this setting is a masterclass. Pure psychological engineering. The basement isn't just a space. It's an environment specifically designed to maximize dread. Not through overt violence or jump scares, but through atmosphere. Pervasive, almost imperceptible. Imagine the absolute quiet, the unnatural silence, punctuated by maybe. Long silences, stretches of dead air that feel heavier than any sound, or those subtle, maybe off-frequency distortions, sounds vibrating just beneath conscious hearing, making you question your own senses. These aren't dramatic swells or loud bangs. They're what some call analog terror textures, sounds that don't announce themselves but seep into your awareness, subtly altering your perception, like a dripping tap driving you mad. The pervasive dead air isn't just absence of sound, it's palpable tension, a deliberate void signaling a bigger unseen mechanism at play. Something vast, indifferent, operating just beyond your grasp. And the physical features of the board, the stark colors, those chilling doorways as deeds, they blur the line even further. Between the physical space and the game's abstract rules, it makes you feel like the very act of existing in that space, of just moving through it, is like signing away something fundamental. Your autonomy, your safety, your future. The children aren't just playing a game, they're trapped psychologically. Their understanding of the world is rewritten by the architecture itself, with rules they can never truly grasp or escape.
And the core mechanics of this game, this horrific board, they were just utterly dehumanizing. It wasn't about typical game rules, you know, where actions lead to predictable results, or even normal punishment meant to correct behavior. No, this is about a profound rewiring, of their understanding of reality, agency, control. Children who would land wrong didn't face a penalty box or lose a turn. They would simply vanish till morning. No explanation, no struggle, no witness, just gone. And those who landed on jail, they weren't given a sentence. They were locked until you stopped asking why. This isn't about justice or even retribution. This is about breaking the spirit, crushing curiosity, making silence and unquestioning acceptance the only path to a temporary, conditional reprieve. It's an active assault on their sense of self, their ability to process the world.
This immediately raises a terrifying question, doesn't it? About the psychological devices being used here. These mechanics aren't just superficially scary. They are precisely engineered to deeply destabilize the psyche, to systematically dismantle a child's grasp on causality and logic. The repeated disappearances, the disorienting arbitrary rules, they create what psychologists might call memory loops. That unsettling feeling of having already been here, but the room had changed. A profound sense of displacement where logic unravels. And the accounts we hear of children, when they return, forgetting things too quickly or remembering too clearly but with crucial gaps. That sounds like classic memory distortion. This isn't just misremembering a detail. It's when trauma actively scrambles your brain's ability to form coherent narratives. You get fragmented recollections, maybe suppression of memories, which can paradoxically make the feeling of the experience stronger, more unsettling, even if the specifics are hazy. The pattern logic of vanishing in confinement, the consistent, inexplicable nature of it, instills this deep dread. a subtle repeated trauma. Not one big event, but a constant low-level hum of terror. What was particularly insidious is the reported lack of appropriate emotional reactions. Instead of panic or pleading, you hear about this confused resignation, a bewildered acceptance. That makes the horror far more profound because it suggests the game succeeded in reshaping their very capacity for emotional response. And the focus on contradiction is key. How could a child vanish from a locked square, defying physics? What does it mean to be jailed until you stopped asking why, punishing the act of inquiry itself? This actively subverts rational thought, forces them into a state of bewildered, helpless submission.
It's almost unimaginable. I mean, think about that fundamental human fear, the fear of inexplicable disappearance, just ceasing to be without reason, without warning, and then couple that with the utter disempowerment when basic questions of the very essence of curiosity, of needing to understand, are met not with answers, but with more confinement, with brutal silencing. What really stands out here is the chilling realization that it wasn't about finding answers, it was about extinguishing the questions themselves, making inquiry dangerous, punishable.
Precisely. The goal isn't just to punish specific actions, but to redefine the acceptable limits of inquiry, agency, even thought. It's a foundational lesson in a terrifying curriculum, a syllabus designed purely to teach passive acceptance. And frankly, it's that curriculum that reveals the collector's true, chilling genius, moving beyond simple scare tactics to something far more systemic.
That's the profound revelation, isn't it? Because when you really unpack what he was doing, it wasn't just feeding on fear, like in many horror stories, not psychological vampirism. Instead, the truly unnerving insight from the sources is he wasn't feeding on fear, he was rewiring. His purpose was far more ambitious, more chilling, infinitely more insidious, to instill a specific, deeply deterministic worldview in these children, a worldview where luck decides the owner, suggesting any success or freedom is just capricious chance, not earned merit. And even more profoundly, that wins in existing has a feat, meaning your very presence, your breath, isn't an inherent right. It's a precarious achievement, a state that has to be constantly justified, paid for. This was a fundamental, deeply unsettling shift in their understanding of their own agency, their place in the world, reducing their existence to a precarious, earned privilege, not an inherent right.
This is where we need to do a sort of forensic breakdown of this forced education because of the masterclass in psychological manipulation. The dice for chance in this game. It served as a brilliant, though incredibly cruel, illusion of agency. It provided the superficial veneer of free will, a deceptive mechanism suggesting outcomes were somehow up to fate or even the child's role. But underneath that, the core lesson was brutal, absolute, unyielding, rent for obedience. This exposed the truth that existence itself wasn't a given. It was conditional, dependent entirely on submission to an unseen authority, an owner whose will was absolute, inscrutable. This goes way beyond simple punishment or even trauma. It aims to imprint a worldview where your very being is precarious, always subject to the capricious will of an owner. It's an elegant, horrifying system, and it exemplifies that principle. Everything is part of something larger, a system, a cover-up, a pattern, a test. The collector, in his suit and hat, acts as the grim, silent administrator of that system, a living embodiment of its cruel rules, not necessarily the creator, but its most chilling enforcer.
And when we frame the collector's methods, what we really see is this chilling, almost perfect example of bureaucratic horror. The rules of his game land wrong, vanish, land on jail, be silent. They were profoundly impersonal, unyielding, enforced with this unknowable absolute authority. There's no appeal, no explanation, no human contact for mercy, just the cold, unwavering application of the board's logic. It's the terror of the indifferent system. And the concept of debt here, it went far beyond money. It became existential, a perpetual obligation just for existing, for occupying a space on the board, for continuing to breathe. It's not just money, it's your very being that's leveraged.
Exactly. And this approach focuses critically on why things were enforced, not just what happened. The game's purpose was never about the children's well-being, or even their entertainment. Its true goal was to mold a particular type of subject, to enforce a specific understanding of power dynamics, social hierarchy. The collector, embodying that cold, dispassionate apparatus of a larger systemic control, where the individual is just a pawn in a grander oppressive design. The lessons weren't for the children's benefit. They were for the perpetuation of a system that demanded unquestioning compliance, absolute submission. It's a chilling reminder that some systems are designed to operate with an impersonal logic that makes individual suffering irrelevant. It focuses solely on the efficient extraction of compliance. And while you say bureaucratic horror, and I agree with the principle, you could argue the term almost softens it. This isn't just frustrating paperwork. It's bureaucracy designed to annihilate self-will.
That's a fair point. It really makes you think, doesn't it? While the scale and the overt cruelty are vastly different, you can still draw some compelling parallels to today. Think about how real-world systems, debt, bureaucracy, control, can feel equally impersonal, overwhelming, designed to incrementally strip away agency. They subtly enforce obedience, conformity, often without us even realizing the extent of it. Consider, like, the modern credit score system, an abstract number dictating housing, business opportunities, often without clear human reasons for its changes, or navigating healthcare, immigration systems, complex, seemingly arbitrary rules determining access to essentials, family reunification, not based on need, but on impersonal adherence to a rule. The rules are set, outcomes dictated, the individual often feels like a helpless pawn, a player without agency. It's a powerful, unsettling echo of the collector's board, just more diffused, less overtly terrifying, maybe?
Indeed. It forces us to confront the idea that these aren't just historical curiosities. They're insidious blueprints for control that persist, adapt across generations, often disguised in new, seemingly harmless forms. The rent we pay might not be children's nights, literally, but the psychological, economic, systemic costs can be just as profound, just as real. The core mechanism remains, a pervasive system subtly exacting a toll for the privilege of merely existing within its boundaries. The true horror isn't just the collector himself, but the enduring legacy of his methodology, the way the game's logic continues to dictate the terms of our lives.
And here's where the legend takes an even more chilling turn, extending its tendrils not just into the past, but disturbingly into our present. Decades after the collector's reign, after his name faded, the board itself, that instrument of terror, of enforced submission, it returned, but now as a toy. Just imagine that profound, almost grotesque irony. The device of psychological torment, of existential debt, repackaged, sanitized, sold for amusement in bright boxes. Crucially, the original dark warning was trimmed until it grinned. Its true horrifying nature was systematically stripped away, replaced by this deceptive, cheerful facade. But the uncanny resemblances were apparently undeniable. Same hat, same suit, same smile. A direct, disturbing lineage. It makes you wonder if it ever truly left, or if it was just waiting patiently for the right cultural moment to reemerge to continue its work under a new, more palatable guise. It's a subtle evolution of horror, a normalization of the sinister.
This transformation, from terrifying legend to innocuous toy, it's a fascinating and deeply unsettling case study. In folkloric adaptation, the insidious nature of cultural memory. This process perfectly demonstrates how horror doesn't always fade. Sometimes it persists, escalates subtly. It aligns with that idea that stories should be slowly escalating, never front-loaded. The real horror isn't just the historical events safely in the past. It's insidious reemergence and normalization now, almost as if sanitizing it makes it more potent, more pervasive. The darkly poetic tone of this shift really highlights the loss of the original cautionary meaning. What was once a stark warning against unseen control, a narrative meant to alert people, is now replaced by a deceptive, grinning facade. A benign image encouraging engagement, not caution. The modern toy makes the horror more accessible, more pervasive, like a cursed audio file playing in the background of everyday life, subtly affecting us without our conscious recognition. It's a trick, isn't it? Sleight of hand that weaponizes nostalgia.
And the unsettling part, the truly chilling contemporary evidence of this legend's ongoing impact, it's that this isn't just a metaphor. At first, people apparently laughed at the resemblance of the toy, dismissed its origins as coincidence, a macabre joke, urban legend. But then a distinct pattern of consequences allegedly began to manifest in real lives, eerily echoing the collector's original work as if the game never stopped. We hear accounts, people losing houses to inexplicable fires, jobs vanishing overnight without cause, families experiencing disruptions that seem to unravel them. It's as if the game never ended, as if it still collects its rent today through these seemingly unrelated misfortunes, impacting lives far beyond any physical board. It sounds fantastical, I know, but the consistency of the reports, the pattern, it's deeply unnerving.
And this is precisely where we can unveil that systemic continuity, where even a skeptic has to acknowledge something deeply unsettling might be at play. We could apply the concept of parasitic footage metaphorically. The more people engaged with, played this normalized, sanitized version, the harder it became to prevent the subtle unraveling of their lives. It's as if participation, however innocent, granted the system renewed access. The collector's influence remains ambient. Never directly visible, no clear cause and effect you can easily pin down, yet consistently corrupting outcomes. These contemporary losses, the houses, jobs, family strife, they don't feel like just random misfortune, the chaos of life. They feel too deliberate, too consistent with the original theme. They feel like part of the bigger thing that refuses to be seen. A continuation of the original lessons of debt, obedience, now operating on a grander, more diffused, and frankly, more insidious scale because it's disguised as fun. This connects right back to that core belief. Knowledge is most valuable when understood and applied. And here the collector's perverse knowledge of control is still being applied. Still exacting its toll, maintaining its grip. These events feel less like coincidence and more like they're being, well, recorded, flagged, part of an ongoing archive of incidents, even if the logs are unseen by us, constantly updated by a system we barely comprehend, let alone control.
So it challenges us fundamentally, doesn't it, to consider how pervasive these systems of control established long ago really are, how they persist, adapt, take on new, seemingly innocuous forms. They still demand a form of rent for existing, for participating, often without our explicit awareness. We might think we're playing a harmless game or navigating a neutral system, but beneath the surface, the dark, unspoken rules of the collector's board might still be silently dictating our moves, collecting their due, influencing our fortunes. It's a chilling thought that some games, once set in motion, never truly end.
Indeed. And the question becomes, if the original terrifying warning was trimmed until it grinned, are we even capable of recognizing the true sinister nature of the game anymore? Or have we been so subtly conditioned, so desensitized by its smiling facade that we just accept the smile as benign even as the rent is collected? Are we playing the game or is the game playing us, using our very acceptance as its ultimate currency?
We've journeyed through this unsettling legend of the collector. From his historical emergence, that sinister figure demanding children's nights, to the psychological engineering of his basement board, where vanishing acts and enforced silences taught those chilling lessons in submission, the precariousness of existence. We've traced its unsettling, grinning echo into modern society, where a terrifying warning got repackaged as a toy, yet maybe continues to collect its insidious rent, ruined lives, inexplicable misfortunes. This isn't just a fantastic tale, just dark folklore for entertainment. It feels like a profound, terrifying lesson in the enduring dynamics of power, control, and perceived value, forcing us to confront the true, hidden cost of agency.
And that, I think, is the lasting power of this kind of dark folklore. It serves not just as entertainment, but as a stark, unforgiving mirror, highlighting inconvenient, uncomfortable truths about ownership, debt, the subtle illusion of choice that often governs our lives. The true horror here, and perhaps in many stories like it, isn't in the supernatural spectacle. It's in the systemic, in those unseen mechanisms that adapt, persist, operate beneath the surface of everyday life, shaping our experiences, extracting their due in ways we might not fully grasp. The story urges us to constantly question who truly benefits from the games we play and who ultimately sets the rules of the board we find ourselves on.
So next time you pass, go. Remember, you're not circling for yourself.
You're circling for the man who owns the board.